Welcome to Building Tomorrow, a show about the ways technology and innovation are making the world a safer, more peaceful, and more prosperous place. Have you ever made a move to a different state or a city and been shocked at the increased sticker price when buying a home? Maybe you just chalked it up to the natural cost of living in a desirable area, putting your kids in the best public school district, or being close to a thriving job market. So you swallow your discontent and pay what you have to pay. But here's the dirty little secret of urban housing in America. A significant portion of that increase in median housing cost is entirely unnecessary, an artifact of zoning boards and other ill-conceived housing policies. And here to discuss this subject with me this week is Salim Firth, an economist and a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center, specializing in urban planning, among a host of other subjects. But welcome to the show, Salim.
Thank you so much.
So we're here in D.C. I know some of our listeners are in places like D.C. We have listeners across the country, but you know, lots in New York, Los Angeles, Chicago. So if you just had the state of the field, what are some of the trenchant problems in urban housing right now?
So right now, everybody is focused on what we're even calling a crisis of affordability. Mm. That housing in the biggest, best job markets in the United States is out of reach for typical people, people with mid-level skills who would be earning kind of average incomes wherever they move. They look at a Los Angeles or a Boston and they say, I can't make it work there. Hmm. And so they end up taking lower salaries and living in places like Dallas or Atlanta, which is fine and those are great, but they would earn more and be more productive if they had the full choice of the United States, and they don't have that choice because they can't afford to live in the lifestyle that they can reasonably expect with a middle income if they're in one of those coastal markets.
And it's not would not only be better for them to not be priced out of cities like that, but it'd be better for the economy and society on the net as well, right? Like they'd be in theory more productive, able to advance their skills in key ways if they felt free to move wherever they wanted.
That's right. So, you know, goods that are traded across the world, like say computer code or anything manufactured or high-level services, those are, you know, those have to compete globally. Mm-hmm. And so when we see that, you know, computer programmers make far more in San Francisco than they make in Austin, well, they have to be paid more to live there, but they wouldn't be able to be paid more unless they were more productive. Mm-hmm. And if the cost of living was lower in San Francisco, more programmers would move there instead of moving to Austin, because for whatever reason, the combination of entrepreneurial skill and finance and teams of elite programmers makes everybody better.
There's that kind of natural clustering effect, which on the industry-wide scale, I mean, it's not unlike when you go to, on a very local level, if you want to shop at the Home Depot, you'll notice the Lowe's is right across the street. Right. And that's on a small scale, but it's true that like industries benefit from clustering and from close geographic proximity. And I wonder to some extent if that covers up some of this problem. If people mentally think, okay, housing prices are high because my income's high, rather than realizing I'm sure some part of that is true, that because there's a thriving tech industry in Silicon Valley, that naturally housing prices would be a little higher than otherwise. But a big chunk of that is not correlated to that at all. It has to do with other factors. So like, what are the things that we can fix? I mean, we're not going to, no one here at Cato is going to say we should have less economic growth and innovation so that we have lower housing prices. I mean, that works. You go to Cleveland, it's right. Just not a booming tech hub. Housing prices are low, but that's not a good thing. But what are the things we can control? Like, so what are driving?
Right. Well, so to back to the thing that you said before that, there are certainly places that are highly restrictive, but they don't have thriving economies, so housing prices are not particularly high. So if you think of Rhode Island, it's just as restrictive legally as Massachusetts, but the economy is a lot weaker, so housing prices are lower. Mm. So that's essentially – high prices tell you that you do have restrictive zoning or land use, but there are other places that don't have the high prices.
Right.
That also have that. But yeah, so what to do? I mean, in a sense, this is the easiest big problem in America because when every problem you have looks like the lack of a house, a hammer is a really good tool.
That's a good line. Yeah. Yeah, right. So you can build more houses.
Right. So it's yeah, in one sense, it's extremely simple. And then the problem is sort of like, well, can I build a house? And then somebody says, no, you cannot build a house. And then that's the problem, is convincing the person who says you cannot build a house to let you build a house.
Mm. So, I mean, it's a very simple problem and it's straightforward. Rising house prices mean that demand isn't matching supply. Mm-hmm. So you increase supply. This should be straightforward. Most housing construction is done by the private sector. So I guess what's the answer? Why aren't houses being built to match that demand?
So let's just walk through the sort of to build a house. What does it take to do even the simplest piece of residential real estate development in the US? So from a sort of physical point of view, you need a piece of land, you need labor, materials, and a little bit of physical capital, you know, the machines that you use to actually do the building. And from a financial perspective, there's something that I call the financial stack, which is a, you know, sort of a programming term, you know, the idea of there's all these different pieces of code that build on each other to create a program like Microsoft Word. In finance, you know, it starts with the mortgage underwriters, which are usually the Fannie and Freddie or the FHA, but sometimes private. And they work about the same way, that they're sort of doing really large scale insurance of millions and millions of mortgages. Then there's banks and lenders that are actually doing the underwriting. And, you know, then there's the developer who, you know, takes out a big loan to do some big project, and then they hire contractors. Mm-hmm. And every step of this process has to justify to the step above it that it is a good project. Mm. So this actually makes it hard to be creative. So I think there are really interesting market problems. Even if we stripped away all of the regulatory aspects, the housing market is a really interesting multi-stage market. You can't at a large, you can do this, you know, on your own property if you want to do something really funky and creative and you're allowed to, great. But funky and creative is actually really hard. Mm-hmm. And so in places where there's lots of land and it's easy to sort of do cookie cutter projects, you know, like Texas, Atlanta, the private sector works pretty well. It knows how to do a subdivision. It's done many of them, and it says, okay, these are the housing prices in the area. This is the trajectory. This is the population growth. We believe there'll be demand for this when you complete the project in 5 years. And we know what the cost of building, you know, 2,000 square foot homes on 10,000 square foot lots is. And you can sort of, every step of that process is straightforward. Mm-hmm. So one thing just that I like to think about is how this private market works. And there is room, I think, for a lot of creativity and growth on the private side. And how do we find new financial solutions to, and then sometimes technical ones when you're looking at sort of the physical, how do we bring down the actual construction costs in really dense places where there isn't a lot of land available for standard method construction? That's just the private side.
Yeah, yeah.
Now the government side is then, you know, complete Byzantine morass.
It's already this even in the ideal conditions, it's already a complicated multi-agent, multi-stage process. And that's leaving aside, yeah, this Byzantine morass.
Yes. Yes. So the Byzantines. This is an interesting case where local government is the most important and most restrictive aspect of government. Mm. The federal government actually has really very few regulations and requirements on the housing market. There's fair housing laws. So you know, you can't discriminate. There are some the states have building codes and basic safety standards and work standards, which nobody really objects to. And then the local governments, they're the ones who are putting in tons of regulations. The states delegated their power of using the police power of the state over land use back in the early 1920s. And what we had was the proliferation of local zoning codes. Each city or county tends to have its own zoning code. Mm. And what a zoning code does is it says what you can use a specific piece of land for. And so they'll be in a typical city anywhere from maybe 20 to 200 distinct zones with Baroque titles that don't aren't the same from one city to another. So, you know, R7 in one city will be S1 in another city. And it's very hard to compare these unless you're, you know, an expert who's working in that area. And so your R7 might be, you can build on in an R7 zone, you can build single family houses on lots of at least 7,000 square feet in size. They have to have setbacks on the front of 25 feet, on each side of 15 feet, but a little bit less if it's a shed. And on the back, the main structure has to be 50 feet from the back of the lot, but a auxiliary structure like a garage or a shed can be only 10 feet from the back. So they'll have all these things. Yeah. They will regulate the pitch of the roof, the height of the structure. In some places, they'll regulate the materials used as a way to keep housing costs up, right? So if you want to be an exclusive affluent community, one way to do that is to make sure that people are building with high-end materials so that only high-end homes can be built in your town.
I've heard some controversy over, like, what was I reading recently about wood stick frames. And so if capping – the new techniques, construction techniques have allowed – using wood frames rather than, you know, metal for certain height buildings. Like, we can actually use wood for those purposes, but that's too cheap. And so there's an interest in, well, we're going to force people to use metal even though it's no longer really necessary, because that way we can prevent higher buildings, which more development, more people, et cetera.
Yeah. Right. I think what's interesting, so first of all, cities have this power. They have the power to say, we can tell you exactly what you can and cannot do to a really fine level of detail on every piece of private property in the city. Yeah. And I think it's actually – people think that developers are really well connected and have all this power. And they often are well connected, but being well connected just means they know who to call and say, mother, may I? ultimately, the local authorities have just an absolutely phenomenal amount of power. I mean – We couldn't imagine the, you know, a local government saying every citizen, this and only this is the field that you're allowed to work in, right? Now they say, they can say, like, okay, if you want to be a nurse, you have to get these, you know, approvals and licenses, but they don't say you can only be a nurse and you can only be a bartender. So we're doing that with land. Now, land is not people and doesn't have, you know, personality, but it does make it incredibly inflexible, so that places can't shift from one use to another. So the result is Arlington County, Virginia, where I work, has a huge housing shortage and then a 20% office vacancy rate, which is why Amazon chose Arlington, because there were enormous quantities of office space sitting vacant and they could get it for cheap. And that was a good business decision on their part. But this arose from
suboptimal usage of that real estate.
Yeah, so basically the county of Arlington says, well, you know, if we allow housing, then we have to educate people's children, and, you know, there's some social services. So people are quite costly, but offices are really cheap. Office workers typically don't commit violent crimes or create nuisances. They go home at night. So everybody wants to have offices in retail, which pay the taxes and don't cause many problems. And nobody wants to have especially low-income families. Low-income families are sort of the, you know, you want to keep those away. They have children. They're poor. They cause problems. Yeah. So a lot of zoning is about trying to curate who's in your city.
And of course, from a – I mean, if you zoom out to 50,000 feet, this is – the logic for locality – even if the ethics of it are – that's problematic from an ethical perspective. Like, we're going to keep out poor people because they're – you know, we don't want poor people here. That's problematic from an ethical standpoint. But if you set aside even the ethics, while it makes sense from a local perspective, like for larger communities, like for an entire city, this is suboptimal because it's not like you're just displacing folks. I mean, they're going somewhere. And so if you are suboptimally – structuring your broader community, pushing people into places where they're not going to be as productive, they're not going to be as prosperous, is happy. You're hurting the city to help the locality, basically. In some, or you can. I mean, I was reminded your in one of your articles. We'll put a link to your American Affairs article in the show notes. You gave, I think it was Trumbull, Connecticut, and right across the road from each other, there's like the good side of the tracks and the bad side of the tracks, and they put a development of like 200 units on the good side of the tracks, but the approval was only for 1 and 2 bedroom units, because 1 and 2 bedroom units aren't going to attract folks with large families. And it's going to attract like young, upper income, young professionals with relatively few children.
Yeah, that's right.
Not larger families of poorer families. And so it can be a mechanism, whether that's the intent or not. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. It can be a mechanism of socioeconomic and even racial segregation.
That's right.
Right. I mean, that it's very perverse.
And you end up with, you know, people who, you know, couldn't dream in their sort of private or expressive life of saying anything bad about, you know, disadvantaged racial minorities.
Yeah.
Then rabidly, you know, pursuing local policies of exclusion.
Yeah.
We're seeing this in San Francisco right now, where the city's trying to put some what they call navigation centers, which is essentially sort of homeless shelters with services to help homeless people. They're trying to distribute them around the city. And wealthy, progressive San Franciscans are raising large sums of money in GoFundMes to oppose homeless services in their neighborhoods. So everybody wants to do something about the homelessness problem, but they want to do it somewhere else.
Do it over there. And for this is audio. I'm gesturing to the other side of the room. We want to do something for those poor folks as long as they stay over there. Yeah.
And homeless people obviously are more stressful or, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
Riskier feeling than, say, a working class immigrant family, but working class immigrant families face really the same level and universality of opposition. That there's virtually no community. It isn't just, and I think this was the case maybe in the 50s, that there were some communities that were really inclusive and said, "Hey, we just build lots of housing and it's cheap and anybody can live here," and others were more exclusive, and it was sort of okay. Different strokes for different folks. You can choose where you want to live. But I think what's really important to recognize is that what we've seen is a homogenization of land use policy over time. So that in these coastal metro areas, nobody wants to include lower income families. And it's sort of a race to everybody wants to attract the 60-year-olds with large incomes. Everybody wants to attract the office buildings, and nobody wants the you know, trailer park.
Yeah, which can make life very hard. I mean, the folks bearing the greatest cost of these policies, or the greatest ill effects, I should say, are those who can least afford it functionally. I mean, something else you mentioned, Salim. So the issue of developer power, like, so you're a private developer, you want to turn this, you know, plot of land into 50-unit apartment building or something. While it's not as simple as saying there's a quid pro quo going on every time you want to get approval for a project. I mean, that does happen. I mean, bribery and corruption is a thing in that area. But even in the best case scenario, even one that doesn't involve some kind of overt corruption, I was struck by how the system itself actually encourages a kind of – it creates an access problem. So I think the term is variances. Mm-hmm. So in effect, a lot – it sounds like – and maybe I'm wrong here, but it sounds like in a lot of areas, in most urban areas, essentially nothing is legal when it comes to construction. But like everything is – the default is nothing is allowed until you ask for us to make it allowed. Mm-hmm. And so the variance is, okay, we get that our codes are so restrictive that you can't develop anything. So we'll make exceptions or variances for you if you apply for permission for those variances. And you need to get those variances in order to build anything functionally in an urban area, but the only people who have you have to know the right people, you have to have some kind of background and experience in applying and successfully in getting these. You have to be willing to wait. It prolongs the process. I mean, the whole thing seems calculated to create an access problem for new developers, new construction, folks who aren't already familiar and baked into the system. Do I have that variances system right?
Yeah. So variances are often the smaller scale ones. Okay. So if you own a particular piece of property and you want to change the use, say you would like to open a guitar store in a place that's zoned for only grocery and convenience stores, you know, you go and you say, hey, look, this isn't actually going to cause that much trouble in the neighborhood. And they say, oh, yeah, you're right. We don't even know why we have this rule. We'll give you a variance. Okay. So there's a lot of small variances like that. Or maybe you're a developer and, you know, the way that your property works out, you're supposed to have 7,000 square feet, but one works out to 6,900. And they say, okay, that's close enough. Mm-hmm. So a lot of variances are kind of small exceptions. The really big developer ones that we see now are what are called PUDs, planned unit developments. So it's the worst word. I hate this word. And planned unit developments are essentially the planners get some creative power. The city planners, they use this restriction on especially doing big projects to say, well, okay, so you can't do this by right, but if you come to us, then we'll work with you and we'll tell you which materials to use and how it should look. And so it's essentially the city giving itself creative control. And that's kind of in the good case scenario. So that's what happens in pro-growth cities. Like, shockingly, Washington is actually a really good area for growth.
No, really.
Does not feel like a cheap area to live when you live here. But if you compare it to a lot of the other coastal cities, it's actually quite good. Hmm. So in Washington, you know, there's some strict limits that you can't break, like the height limit. But there's a lot of other things that you can sort of compromise with the city on. And the way you do this is the planned unit development and a community benefit agreement if you're in a neighborhood. So you're going to give some money to the, you know, fund some local services or pay for some local affordable housing. So you sort of make some side payments, which may be kind of optimal in a Kosian sense. It's hard to say. And
it's better that you can make the payments and build than that you
wouldn't
can't.
Be allowed to. Yeah. Right. So it might be better. It might be better. And it might be that there are some real externalities to doing major projects and that, you know, it's really proper that you have to pay for some of the services that the city is then going to have to be providing. Right. Transportation and roads, and you are going to congest things. And so, I don't reject out of hand the idea that major changes should pay for themselves. But what it really – this is all about the city getting creative control and the urban planning profession. So this is a really weird sort of dissonance in urban planning. There are sort of Pharisees of land use in that they all worship the altar of Jane Jacobs, who is this sort of communitarian anti-planner from the 60s who really was the central voice of the anti-highway, anti-urban renewal movement, which said, stop bulldozing organic cities and building these giant centrally planned monstrosities. And she was right about a huge number of things, and everybody sort of venerates her now.
Yeah. You're not going to hear me defending Robert Moses and the big
right.
Yeah, old school planners.
And you don't even hear the central planners defending Robert Moses anymore. So the central planners disavow central planning. And so they all sort of, you know, light their candle every morning to Jane Jacobs.
Yeah.
But the structure of the profession is such that a whole bunch of people who all believe Jacobs and notionally believe in, you know, organicness, bottom-up urban planning, organic growth.
Multi-use districts and all that.
Yeah. But they are planners, and what they do is plan.
Yeah.
And they just can't get away from that. And they can't unplan. They can't, you know, remove themselves from the equation. So, you know, you can use, say, the planning expenditure of a city as a rough measurement of how restrictive it is. So even though it's spending this money hiring people who are allegedly against central planning or philosophically against it, functionally what they end up doing is imposing the same kinds of restrictions and the same kinds of forms everywhere. So if, you know, development in a certain city at a certain time all kind of looks the same. Mm. It's because the same small set of people have creative control.
At the end of the day, you have a group of folks who, even when their intentions are good, right? They want to imitate Jane Jacobs. They want lots of, you know, multi-use districts. They want They want to avoid certain things like gentrification. They want to undo historic problems like redlining. Their motives, I mean, this isn't to impugn their motives. The motives are always good, but you end up against something libertarians love to criticize, which is the knowledge problem, Hayek's knowledge problem, right? That like no matter how smart or well-intentioned or experienced you are, cities are complicated organisms, right? Towns. I mean, we talked about any individual property is a really complicated question of the interests of all those who live around it, the interests of the city and additional people in the schools and additional cars in the street, the interests of what kind of business, a guitar shop or a pawn shop or what. Like any individual project is an incredibly complicated confluence of different interests, different demand, you know, supply and demand, different knowledge sets, et cetera, let alone an entire city. So there's almost a conceit of knowledge that goes on that leads to suboptimal outcomes. Like even when the intentions are good, we want mixed use development, but we're going to decide where that can happen. And there's just a fundamental disconnect there. That's what I'm picking up on.
Yeah. And this is a podcast about innovation, right? So yeah. Fundamentally, what urban planners do is they look for things that have worked in the past, and they try to reapply those. So mixed use is the craze because, of course, we went too far in single use for a long time. But the upshot of that is that we have a lot of empty retail because it turns out that even in New York City, which is our, you know, Manhattan is by far the densest place in America, not every building has ground floor retail.
Yeah.
You can't, even at New York densities, you can't support ground floor retail with, say, 6 or 7 stories a very dense residential. You could put that on the avenues and then on the streets, it's mostly just residential.
To what extent is this because the built infrastructure, I'm always struck by the extent to which the built infrastructure of our cities was so drastically changed from say the 1920s or 30s through the 1960s. And part of this is a story about, you mentioned highways earlier, it's a story about the making cars the centerpiece of American built infrastructure. That like my understanding is that New York at the turn of the 20th century, so New York 100 years ago, it was a very different looking place. Stuff was by nature very mixed use. There's no zoning, but there's also no cars, and so folks need to walk to work. I mean, some folks have, you know, horses and ride for, but generally folks have to walk to work, take early public transit. Elevated lines are starting to go up by then. But we shifted, we drastically changed the lived daily paradigm of what it meant to live and work in the city. And now we're trying to, you know, reel that back in by forcing mixed use development. But the still basic infrastructure still is all geared around vehicular traffic. Like,
yeah.
So it almost feels like it's a futile effort to put back in the box what's gotten out.
So I differ with a lot of urbanists in that I think cars are great.
Okay, you're pro car.
I'm pro car. Now, I'm not pro car everywhere, and you know, this sort of this Manichaean divide when you get into these debates of like either cars are always good everywhere or cars are never good anywhere. And I think that if you read Alain Berteau's new book, Order Without Design, which is a fantastic piece on it's sort of urban economics for urban planners. Oh, cool. With a global perspective, because he's like the Indiana Jones of urban planning and has, you know, worked in Jakarta and Yemen and Beijing and all these places around the world in the past, you know, 50-year career. So he's a really interesting guy. But his main point about cities is they are about the thickness of labor markets. So a city is fundamentally a labor market. People move there to work, and they don't move there usually for one job. And this is something I think that maybe elites get wrong, because we do move for one job, right? I got a PhD in economics, and I literally had a global job search trying to match one economist with one job. And I could have moved to Wellington, New Zealand, or the middle of Iowa somewhere, and it's just sort of that's the way this very elite job market works, and it's similar for people in journalism and think tanks, et cetera. That's not normal.
Mm.
And for normal people in normal job markets, what you need is thickness. You need to be able to, from a given location, get to not just your job or a job, but get to a large selection of jobs. And if you're an employer, the same token, you need lots of potential employees, not just your current employees, to have access to you. So the U.S. kind of romanticizes this kind of weird moment in history where we had and I think this was because of the nature of early electric power. We had very distributed manufacturing. Right, so every town with a waterfall had a factory, and they became little factory towns. That's actually a really dysfunctional economy, right? It creates a monopsonistic labor market. It creates a very fragile city because if the demand for that product goes away or there's a new competitor,
so one company town, right?
So that's actually not great, but it's very romanticized because it happened in a moment when the U.S. was just surging to the forefront of global productivity, and you could be this tiny town in upstate New York making one product, but literally selling it all over the world.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was really fascinating. But this was sort of an accident of where power sources were. And as soon as electric power became not the main thing that you had to build your factories around, or before that, falling water power, then that model disappeared because it actually never made sense to have single factory towns. That's not good for workers. It's actually not great for the employer in the long run. And we're moving back to the sort of several millennia old trend of urbanization where we become more productive as we get bigger and bigger labor markets. All this about the car. The car is great because it gets people from their homes to lots of jobs.
Yeah.
And fixed route transit, which is what is romanticized by most urbanists, it has this major failing that the jobs have to be really concentrated in sort of a central district for the whole fixed route system to make to work. And a lot of people will say, oh, here, look, we're going to build this little urban village and it's going to have everything you need. There's going to be an office building and then a scattering of services, the ones that all the services you would need on a monthly or more basis, and enough people to support all this. And people will leave occasionally, but most people will be able to do all their stuff locally. And that's a total fiction. It's great to have a grocery store and a post office and a library near you. And those are sort of like very generic things. But most people need to search for jobs in a really large market. We don't just take a close job. That's just not – if you sort of poll your friends, that's not how it works. And the car is great because it lets you go in sort of any direction across this overlapping grid. Now, it's bad because the car takes up a lot of space. It takes up space while you're commuting and it takes up space while you're parked. Yeah. So I'm actually really hopeful for the kind of micro-mobility, self-driving, like the different kinds of transit that we are potentially evolving towards, which will potentially solve some of these space problems of cars.
You can have that flexibility,
get you away from fixed route. And I think pro-transit people need to start thinking a lot more about non-fixed route or poly-route transit, like what you get in third world cities where you've got these guys who drive minibuses and they all have slightly different routes. And that functionally serves to create a much thicker grid. So we should be thinking more about getting away from fixed routes and using our gains in technology and the ability to use your phone to know when different kinds of transit are coming.
We'll have to we need to do an episode just on so we did an episode with Jennifer Huddleston Skies from Mercatus about scooters, right? So much down these lines. We need to do
Jennifer will always correct you if you say scooters and say it's micromobility.
Micromobility, yeah. But everyone else says scooters. So sorry, Jennifer. I was gonna say scooter. So you can check out that episode sometime. And we really do need to do more on urban transit, on the tension between everyone loves rail, but really buses are a much better investment if you're going to invest in urban transit. So we need to talk about that at some point. But for sake of talking about housing, so we've got these really intense, even seemingly intractable problems. And part of that is because of, we're talking about millennia old changes in kind of built space. We're dealing with a shift back towards different, a model that's centuries old. So there's only so much that you can do when it comes to pushing back against some of these trends. But there are some interesting things that are being done around the country to try to address the crisis of affordability, to try to reel in some of the worst abuses of, I think zoning, suboptimal uses of zoning power. So why don't we talk about some of those? It might be a term, it's probably, it's familiar to you and the folks who read about urban housing, but maybe not to our listeners. So there's what's called the YIMBY movement. Yes, in my backyard, which is the opposite of...
Not in my backyard, NIMBY.
NIMBY. Okay, so why don't you flesh that? What is that? What's going on there with the NIMBY-YIMBY debate?
So the YIMBY movement is a really interesting case of a group of people who, many of whom felt personally excluded, right? So a lot of them are young renters who say, I am never going to be able to afford to buy my own house in a good commutable neighborhood in Boston or San Francisco or Los Angeles. And the reason is that they won't build houses for me. They're not building enough apartment buildings. And there's also a fundamentally sort of a pro-human aspect to the YIMBY movement. YIMBYs are almost all pro-immigration because it's the same mood affiliation. It's the same sort of feeling about other people that if we all crowd together, we're actually better off. This is fundamentally what a city is. A city is a lot of positive externalities. There are negative ones, and all the textbooks spend 90% of their time on negative externalities. But if positive externalities did not outweigh negative externalities, we would not have urbanized over the last 5,000 years.
Yeah.
So clearly urban externalities are on net positive, and the YIMBY movement at an intuitive level gets this. It says, if we are closer together, if we allow people to do their thing near us, I will be better off, you will be better off, we'll all be better off.
And this is a cross-domain thing. I mean, so when you cluster folks, and the more different, the better, I mean, in a lot of ways. So diversity matters here as well. When you cluster folks together, you spark those serendipitous connections and opportunities. You get clustering effects for industries, a thick labor market, but you also get, I mean, cultural innovation happens in these thick spaces. There's a reason why most trends come out of cities, not out of, you know, rural Iowa, right? So the Harlem Renaissance takes place in Harlem for a reason in the city, right?
Right, not rural Alabama.
Right, yeah. So there's so to your point, I mean, being pro-human means being pro-innovation, being pro urban as well. I mean, like all these things are integrated. Yeah. So where are we seeing this happen? Like my understanding is like San Francisco. It's a little bit surprising to me. It's in progressive cities, actually. Like,
yeah. Well, progressive cities are where the problem is the worst, right? Mm-hmm. So the things, the sort of like radical, crazy ideas that these progressives have would make them more like Dallas.
Mm.
So, you know, on the one hand, yes, the YIMBYs are mostly left-leaning people in very, very blue places. But on the other hand, they're there because that's where the problem is. I think it's actually really instructive that San Francisco is really the hotbed and the home of YIMBYism in a way where it has not nearly caught on as much in Los Angeles and New York.
Interesting.
And San Francisco has a tradition with Silicon Valley of the idea that it's an optimistic city. Problems can be solved. We can, you know, make an app that fixes this. And then there were also just some serendipitous connections. There's a handful of individuals in San Francisco, both in the activist space and then in policy, who put their efforts together and said, we can get to Sacramento first. And so where even in local San Francisco politics, the NIMBY interests, the sort of the homeowners who say, I don't want anything to change in my district. I don't want my home price to go down. I moved here 40 years ago and it's fine. You should just leave.
Yeah.
They are very well represented and very well organized in local politics, but they didn't have any organization in Sacramento. The YIMBYs got there first and went into the legislature and convinced mostly left-leaning legislators that, look, there are these local policies which the state enables that are hurting the poor, that are hurting innovation, that are hurting renters in favor of wealthy homeowners. So it's a sort of very a left-leaning argument that's made there. And I think they also just – when you tap into a problem, when you express a problem with a clear solution and a lot of people have that problem, they say, oh yeah, these people represent me. So it was sort of – it had good representatives out front who made a lot of noise and got in the news by being in Sacramento first. And then people were like, yeah, I support that. So there's this weird case where 2/3 of people in San Francisco support building more housing in their own neighborhoods. But the San Francisco political machine is still deeply entrenched against NIMBYism. So it's still a very NIMBY San Francisco. But the state lawmakers, because this machine hasn't been effective there, they just sort of look at the voters and go, well, look, the voters like NIMBYism. Yeah. And the voters want more housing, and they don't want insane quantities of more housing on their street. But if we can rein in the power of cities to regulate, then what we'll get is a little bit of growth everywhere, which, you know, doesn't turn anybody's neighborhood into a construction zone for 10 years, right? Nobody wants to live in a construction zone. I get that.
Right.
But if you sort of spread this out and say, okay, if every block in suburban California got 2 more houses over the next decade, that wouldn't be revolutionary anywhere, but it would be revolutionary everywhere.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah. So it's rather than thinking of development as, okay, we're going to fight about whether or not this one tract of this city block is going to be turned into 200 apartments, and all the and you know, local single family homes next door are like, well, that's this long project that's going to be very burdensome for me. I get why it's good for the city, but for me, this is going to be a pain. I'm going to be staring at that construction pit for a decade, and then there's going to be all this traffic, et cetera. Instead, you can upzone in a sense, or allow broadly. And my understanding, this happened in Minneapolis recently, like last year, where they basically said, look, across the board, we're going to change single family housing zoning to up to like 3 units.
That's right.
So if you have you want to build up and have a granny flat or have a second floor apartment, go for it. You don't have to come to the zoning board to ask permission. It's just,
or if you want to divide your big old house, which might have been built as a duplex originally and then combined for some big family at some point, but is now illegal to resubdivide, you can resubdivide it.
Yeah.
So Minneapolis put this in their comprehensive plan. And they have fairly strong rules that say that has to get implemented in zoning. So that will be implemented probably this year or next year, where the entire city of Minneapolis becomes, in any residential zone, triplexes, by right. So you can build a 3-unit building. And that's actually how Minneapolis grew up originally. This is just going back to kind of the norm that had been then sort of choked off over years of NIMBYism and ratcheting down what people are allowed to do with their land. So the sort of promising approach, I do think local engagement is really important. And I actually think some of the NIMBYs, some of the YIMBYs, because of their early success in Sacramento, believe that they can just win at the state. And I don't think, like, the NIMBYs are eventually going to, they organize really, really well for the last half century. I don't think they're going to suddenly stop organizing well and yield state houses to the YIMBYs everywhere. So you actually have to win this argument. And the argument usually, you know, it's played out at the local level. So what your listeners can do is sort of go to their local planning meeting when there's hearings about some project in their neighborhood and say, yes, in my backyard. Yeah, I want this built.
Yeah.
I support this business owner's desire to expand their business. I support this homeowner's desire to build a granny flat. Right now, a lot of hearings only get negative feedback. The only people who show up are those who are angry, because if you don't mind, then you're not passionate, right? Like, people are rarely passionate about somebody else's desire to repaint their house. And so there's the homeowner or the developer who's in favor, and then a bunch of angry neighbors, and all the neighbors who aren't angry are at home, you know, watching something on TV. So part of the YIMBY movement is just saying, we actually need to activate. The planners are often on our side philosophically, but, you know, they listen to this public feedback and they can't kind of justifiably say, well, public feedback was mixed, so we're going to do the right thing.
Yeah.
If we force public feedback at least to be mixed, then they have a lot more room to say, yeah, there's no reason we shouldn't allow a duplex in this neighborhood.
And I think we have to provide folks who are, I mean, so folks who aren't angry about what's happening, who have a, you know, there's a natural, you only do things when you have a motivation.
Sure.
And so if your motivation isn't anger, you need something else, or else you just stay home and Netflix and chill. And that thing can be a sense of altruism, a sense of ethical obligation, that being pro-development means being pro-people, and pro-people who may not look or have the same background as you.
Right. Or earn as much as you.
Earn as much as you. That's what I mean, socioeconomic diversity. So like I think about this all the time, and I actually live most of the week in New Jersey, and there's all this preserved farmland everywhere and preserved open space. It's of course always in the really tony neighborhoods and towns. Every time I see that, like I'm sure the intent was good. You know, that they wanted to preserve this land so that, I don't know, folks wouldn't be detached from nature or...
I'm not so sure the intent was good.
Okay, but... maybe the intent wasn't good. Whatever the intent was, good or ill, the effect is to make this an exclusive, expensive neighborhood that only a certain kind of person, and that cuts across socioeconomic, you know, class lines, income lines, it cuts across in the context of central New Jersey, racial lines. So it's often disproportionately white homeowners in West Windsor keeping poor black homeowners in Trenton.
Right.
Is how, you know, you wanted farmland, what you got was exclusion, right, whether that was your intent or not. And so, but giving people an altruistic sense, the reason why you go to your local zoning hearing is not because you're angry about development. It's because you care about your community and want to see it be a diverse, affordable place.
Right. And this is why the local YIMBY movements are so important, because usually people aren't going to show up at a hearing alone. Nobody wants to be the lone voice. It's not so much fun to do an activity on your own. And so the local YIMBY chapters, which you know listeners can get plugged into in lots of cities, they'll sort of coordinate, okay, a bunch of us are going to go to this hearing. Yeah. And then it becomes a social thing. You're doing something with your friends that's helping your community and representing those who don't yet have a voice in your local political process.
Yeah. That's it's a cool – I think you're right though that we have to focus on this at a local and grassroots level. If you always rely on state preemption, that can go both ways. I mean, you can imagine in some state and organized interest going to the state to ban local YIMBYism, mm-hmm, right? That's just as possible. And so you have to be – there's an issue there. I mean, in general, I think libertarians are going to default towards decentralization and localism. So I'm a little bit squiffy about the idea of state preemption of local preferences. Sometimes it's necessary, but it's problematic for a long-term sustainable movement.
Right. And so the reason New Jersey has this preserved farmland issue is essentially the New Jersey Supreme Court in the 70s in a series of Mount Laurel decisions said every community has to do their share of building multifamily affordable housing. And so the way to get out of doing your share was to say, well, actually, we don't have any land because it's all preserved farmland. And so they sort of said, well, if you grow, you have to be more inclusive in your growth. And some communities said, oh, okay. But a lot of communities just said, okay, we won't grow.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was basically the same in Massachusetts, where there's a law called 40B, which sort of gives this, if you do enough affordable housing in your development, you get to skip some local regulations. And the way to prevent that from happening is just to create conservation land and say, oh, no, this is just going to be forest forever. And that doesn't get counted against you in your 40B allocation because it's meeting this good environmental goal. So there's this sort of – we have to be really careful when you just write – because there's so many ways to regulate land use.
Yeah.
When you just say, okay, we're gonna not allow you to use one form of regulation,
there's
you can find
way.
Other ones, and it might actually be worse.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
So I think it's important to change the hearts and not just the legal structure.
That's a very good point. Yeah, I think we might have to close things off there just for time's sake. But sometime we'll have to have you back on, Salim, to talk about. I know you have thoughts and feelings about local land use here in DC with the RFK Stadium and the Armory redevelopment projects. We'll have to have you on to talk about that. We didn't even really get to touch on gentrification, on addressing historic redlining. So there's a lot more that we need to deal with.
This is a great field.
Yeah. Seriously, this is a great decision for an economist to get into. Why you get an economics degree at Rochester?
At Rochester in macroeconomics, yeah.
And why do you decide, okay, I'm going to go from that to thinking about urban housing, working at Mercatus?
I was working at the Heritage Foundation. I was writing a paper summing up sort of a bunch of different costs of different types of regulations.
Yeah.
And I was just pulling from other academic estimates. Different scholars have estimated these things. And I said, well, housing regulation is clearly going to be one of the biggest. It's a huge market with tons of regulation. And I looked at the literature and lots of papers, but none of them gave me a kind of a rough and ready, like I can put a dollar figure on what regulation nationwide is costing homeowners or you know, citizens, renters, and homeowners alike. And so I said, well, I can, you know, the data's here and I'm an economist. I can estimate this myself. It's not going to be, you know, maybe the world's greatest estimate, but it's somewhere to start. So I did. But I wanted to do better than that first effort. And so I kind of kept pushing on it and pushing on it. And yeah, kind of just went down that rabbit hole and said, this is way more interesting. It's also much more fun at parties to talk about housing than macroeconomics. Yeah. Macroeconomics, people are really confused. They, you know, maybe they know about the Fed or they ask you what stock they should buy. But housing is great because everybody has lived in a house or wants to.
Yeah.
And people have their own stories of real estate. People have really good intuition about how the market works. And that's just a lot more fun to do the research in an area that everybody cares about.
So now we can say Salim Firth, expert economist, senior fellow at the Mercatus Center, and great house party guest. There you go. Well, thank you so much for coming, Salim. And until next week, be well. Thanks for listening. Building Tomorrow is produced by Tess Terrible. If you enjoy Building Tomorrow, please subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about libertarianism, find us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.